Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, and Judge Bryan, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This is court file number 820-0269, State of Minnesota versus Trayvon LaShawn Manuel.
Good morning, everybody. Before we begin, I'd like to go through sort of a roll call to make sure all of our technology is working correctly. I'll start with the judges. Judge Johnson, are you able to hear me okay?
I can hear and see you just fine, thank you.
And Judge Cochran.
I think you're muted, Judge Cochran.
Oh.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Sorry about that. I forgot to turn off the mute button. Thank you.
And Ms. Murphy, are you able to see us and hear us okay?
I am.
And Mr. Maravigli.
Yes, Your Honor, that's Maravigli. And I do hear and see all of you perfectly.
All right, thank you very much. The only other comments I'll make, apart from thanking you all for being flexible and being able to participate in this way, is to keep an eye on the timer. There are different ways that you can view all of the participants. And I think the default view is the active speaker view, which means whoever's talking is kind of blown up. And sometimes parties are unable to see the law clerk or the marshal's timer if they're in that active speaker view. So if you can see the timer, then you're all set. And if it for some reason disappears, maybe you want to toggle through the different options on WebEx to make sure that you know how much time is remaining. And with that, is our counsel ready to proceed?
The state is, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. Counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Rebecca Murphy and I represent appellant State of Minnesota. In this case, respondent was not arrested when officers handcuffed him. The district court found otherwise, and that was by ignoring all of the factors that case law tells us we need to look at in these cases. To review, this was a slumper call. Respondent was the driver in a vehicle stopped at a fast food drive-thru, not at the lunch hour, but at 3:30 in the morning following bar close. The remarks on the call were that employees had been unable to wake respondent. Officers responded, and in reaction to that police response, respondent started to dig around behind him in an area of his vehicle with tinted windows. In response to that, officers said, "Hey, stop digging around there. Put your hands on the steering wheel." They calmly asked him to put the car in park. They calmly asked him to step to remove his seatbelt and step out of his vehicle. That response was in contrast to a more aggressive approach that we see in a lot of other cases where investigative detentions like these were upheld. What the officers didn't do was notable. They didn't block respondent's car with their vehicle. They didn't order him out of the car at gunpoint. They didn't order him onto the ground. This was a measured, reasonable response to respondent's activity. When he came out of the car, he was immediately handcuffed, which is more evidence.
Yes. At any point, did the officers on the scene, there were two, correct?
Yes.
Did either of them ask the individual what he was reaching for behind him in the car, in the vehicle?
I believe based on the body worn camera testimony, they did say, "What were you reaching for?" After they had handcuffed him.
And does the record reflect, do you recall his response or where we can find that in the record?
This would be, or the body worn cameras around probably two and a half minutes in. The respondent doesn't answer.
Thank you.
So counsel, I just want to make sure I understand the argument you're making in this case. You're saying that the defendant was placed in and handcuffed and placed in the backseat of the squad car for officer safety while the officers wanted to conduct a search of the vehicle?
Yes. And what, I'm really, oh, sorry.
What were they searching for?
They were searching respondent and the vehicle for weapons. Respondent's conduct in the totality of has created a reasonable, articulable suspicion, both of criminal activity and of dangerousness. So they had the right to respond reasonably and diligently in effectuating the purpose of that detention, which was to ensure respondent didn't have access to a weapon.
So they're putting him in the backseat of the squad car and handcuffing him in order to conduct a search of the vehicle?
Yes, and the state's not so focused on putting in the squad car. That happened a few minutes after. The district court was really focused on the handcuffing, which is sort of the central argument, I think, at issue here. And it was the purposes of the handcuffing purposes was to remove defendant from where he could reach a weapon to search his person and the vehicle for officer safety.
So if they're responding to a call about a slumper and then they decide to search the vehicle, are they searching the vehicle purely for officer safety, or is this an expansion of the scope of the initial stop?
Well, it was a little bit of both. So the purpose of the stop was to search for weapons based on officer safety, but it wasn't just the slumper call that justified that search. They arrived to investigate the slumper call, and in response to that reasonable police presence, respondent started digging around behind him in a large vehicle with dark tinted windows. And so the respondent's action here is what gave the officers the reasonable articulable suspicion that he may be armed or reaching for a weapon. And that is
so what... Is there any evidence in the record that you're relying on to argue that they had a reasonable suspicion that he was armed? Any evidence other than him reaching back behind him? Is that the sole basis for their suspicion?
The dangerousness, the analysis is definitely focused on the digging around behind him, but then also in context of the suspicion of intoxication and of the officer's training and experience that people who are intoxicated can, scenes can change and evolve quickly. So it was sort of everything put together that contributed to this reasonable articulable suspicion of dangerousness.
How does intoxication lead to a suspicion that someone's armed and dangerous? Or a suspicion of intoxication lead to a suspicion that someone's armed and dangerous?
A suspicion of intoxication alone doesn't lead to a suspicion of someone being armed. But when you have the furtive movements and you also have the intoxication, it adds to the volatility of the situation and the risk of harm to the officers.
So is it your position that anytime an officer suspects a crime and pulls someone over for the suspected crime and sees the person move in the vehicle, that that person can be removed from the vehicle and handcuffed?
These cases are so fact and circumstance driven that it's hard to just take one small fact pattern sort of in a vacuum. It would really depend on the time of day, the circumstances surrounding where the person was, if the person had been unconscious. The case law tells us that we can't get that much benefit from case analyses because these inquiries are so factual in nature. So handcuffing is not always an arrest. There's not always a reason, of course, to do a search for weapons. But on these facts, in these circumstances, the officers acted reasonably and diligently and did have the requisite reasonable articulable suspicion.
So again, I'm trying to make sure I understand the separate steps here. We have one body of case law regarding vehicle searches once the suspicion has been expanded to something other than the basis for the initial stop. We also have a body of case law about what constitutes an arrest separate from the vehicle search. And then there's also a body of case law regarding probable cause to arrest somebody prior to someone being pulled over in a car. And I want to make sure, as we're looking at each of those different aspects of this, are you arguing today or in your brief at all that the furtive movement observed prior to the face-to-face encounter, that furtive movement constitutes probable cause to arrest?
Not in isolation, no.
Okay, well, fine. In combination with the tip that you have a slumper, Because I think that's the extent of what the officers know at that point, that there's a slumper, they know the time of day. And are you saying that in this case, the fact of it a slumper call, the fact of the time of day, the fact of seeing a furtive movement reaching into the back seat, that those things together constitute probable cause to arrest the defendant?
Yes, that is argued in my brief as my third in the alternative argument, that all of these factors in concert. Also, it was a holiday weekend. It was early morning hours following the July 4th holiday, kicking off a holiday weekend. We had that unusual reaction to police presence, and the digging around all would lead a person of ordinary care and prudence to believe that that respondent was in physical control of a vehicle after consuming alcohol.
Ms. Murphy, it seems to me that the appeal rises or falls based upon when he was arrested. The district court said he was arrested at the moment he was removed and cuffed. Your position is that he was not arrested then, he was arrested at a later point in time. It seems to me that, if we were to agree with the district court that he was arrested when he was removed and cuffed, I mean, would you basically agree that there was no probable cause at that time?
No, because we also had an erroneous factual finding here. The district court did find that Officer Josada Mua, the officer who testified, observed the odor of alcohol coming from respondent fairly contemporaneously with the handcuffing, but the district court found that that happened after the handcuffing. The record clearly supports that Officer Josada Mua observed the odor of alcohol before the handcuffing. And so even if this court agrees that handcuffing was a significant event to turn this into an arrest, we have the odor of alcohol preceding the handcuffing. And it's clear from both Josada Mua's—
Weren't they in the process of handcuffing at the time the odor of alcohol was detected, though?
Well, from the body-worn cameras, Officer Tu Mua, Josada Mua's partner, didn't yet have the handcuffs off of his belt at the time that Officer Josada Mua was standing next to respondent and respondent was facing Josada Mua. That's corroborated both by Officer Josada Mua's testimony that he smelled alcohol as he came around respondent's vehicle and as respondent was exiting the minivan, and corroborated by both body-worn cameras that show that at that point in time, Officer Tu Mua didn't have the handcuffs out yet. So both respondent and the district court focus on handcuffing as the key action here that transformed the seizure into an arrest. And for the odor of alcohol to have been observed prior to the handcuff is critical. The record does not support the district court's finding as to the timing of the odor of alcohol, and that changes the probable cause analysis.
Am I correct in understanding that was Tua Mua the driver of the squad car and Josada Mua the passenger?
Yes.
And am I correct then that Tua Mua, they both opened their doors, Tua Mua went to the driver's side of the minivan and Josada Mua the passenger in the squad car went to the passenger side of the minivan, correct?
Correct.
And then Tua Mua, the officer on the driver's side of the minivan, removed him, Josada Mua, then walked around from the passenger side of the minivan to the driver's side of the minivan. It seems to me that the cuffing is not a momentary event. I mean, there was a moment perhaps when Officer Tua Mua began to cuff him, and then there was it took a few seconds, not a long time, but it took a few seconds, partly because he dropped the cuffs on the ground initially and then picked them back up. I think Josada Mua was assisting by perhaps moving Mr. Manuel's right arm into position for being cuffed. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it seems to me that Officer Tua Mua had begun the cuffing before Josada Mua was close enough to Mr. Manuel to smell anything. That's my takeaway from having watched the video. Would you disagree with that?
I would respectfully disagree. I've watched it second by second, and as Josada Mua is standing next to respondent, as he's come around and the respondent is standing out, and nobody grabbed him out of the car, he exited the car, Officer Tu Mua hasn't even yet dropped the handcuffs. So, I mean, it is a matter of seconds, but it's critical that the handcuffs were not in place The observation of that odor of alcohol came prior to placing the handcuffs on respondent.
So if we could put aside the argument you're making that you had that the officers had probable cause to arrest before they approached the vehicle, and if we put aside the alternative argument that there's an expansion of the scope that's reasonable based on the furtive movement itself, and that they're really searching the car for a new offense while they've detained him, let's focus on the primary argument, which it seems to me is there's a suspicion of a DUI and they're doing an investigative detention. And so the question is, when does this arrest occur? My question for you is, in your brief, you're pretty critical of the district court judge for using this language defining when someone is free to leave or when an arrest occurs. So my question is, are you saying that the Supreme Court case law interpreting the Fourth Amendment in Mendenhall, in Brendlin, to say, quote, a seizure occurs if, in view of all the circumstances surrounding the incident, a reasonable person would have believed that he was not free to leave? Are you saying that that has been overruled? If so, what is the case law that overrules Mendenhall and Brendlin?
None. Nothing overrules it, but I think we've seen an expansion, certainly from our own state Supreme Court and State v. Moffitt, where there's a recognition that the not free to leave language isn't all that helpful in the analysis when, of course, somebody's not free to leave because they're being detained as part of a traffic stop, for instance.
I think the language you use in your brief is that that ultimate test has been outright repudiated for Fifth Amendment custodial interrogation and cautiously rejected. So are you saying that the Supreme Court of the United States has repudiated it or rejected it? Or are you saying that the Minnesota Supreme Court has repudiated and rejected this interpretation that is directly tied to Mendenhall and Brendlin?
I'm saying that the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that it is a totality of the circumstances test and that not free to leave can't be the single factor test. Mendelson has not been directly challenged by the United States Supreme Court. Of course, I don't have the power to call anything bad law. It's not bad law. It's simply not, I think, a full expression of where the law has moved since then. A Terry analysis now is broad. It looks at all relevant factors, and whether or not someone is free to leave doesn't help in a circumstance where we're saying, of course, they've been legitimately seized as part of a traffic stop.
Are there other questions from either Judge Johnson or Judge Cochran before we move on?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Maravilli.
Thank you, Your Honor. And good morning to the court and counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the respondent in this case, Mr. Trayvon Manuel. And I would just like to begin by saying that in reading this judge's order, she got it right. There are several bases for me being able to take that position. And even as counsel was pointing out about wading into the case law, yes, it is case by case, but the touchstone of Fourth Amendment analysis is reasonableness. And the judge focused on the actions of this office, of these officers, in relation to what they saw when they arrived and the information they had before they arrived. Now, I want to take this opportunity, if I may, to clarify the record. First, that counsel saying repeatedly that Mr. Manuel was digging in the back seat does not reflect the record. The judge found, as was stated in the record and in testimony, that as the officers approached with their emergency lights activated, Mr. Manuel reached. That is what the district court found on page one of her order. He was ordered to stop and he did so immediately. Secondly, to jump ahead here, as was stated on page 13 of the transcript during Officer Mua's direct testimony, at 1:42 of the body camera, Jisada Mua was in the process of handcuffing Mr. Manuel when Mr. Tuamua came up alongside him. That is what the district court found. So the judge's comment earlier that they were in the process of handcuffing is correct. Now the district court judge here.
Mr. Mayor, I believe if I may stop you there. So that.
Yes, sir.
What you just said, I think, would be the opposite of what I was thinking, that Tuamua was the driver, Jasadamua was the passenger in the squad car. And I guess, we have one witness at the hearing, and that was Officer Jasadamua, and it wasn't entirely clear from his testimony which position he was in. But do you think, when I had a colloquy with Ms. Murphy about the positions of those officers, do you think that she and I are incorrect about that?
First, I guess, Your Honor, I immediately felt the need to apologize if I'm interchanging the first names here. I'm trying to look at my brief here.
That's what I think you did, and I wasn't sure if that was if you had a different understanding or if that was unintentional.
No, if there's any difference here, it's just in mistaking the identity of the officers, and I apologize. The facts that the district court found are that one officer Mua was in the process of handcuffing Mr. Manuel when the other officer Mua came alongside him at 1:42 on the body camera. And as the district court found in her order, this constituted an arrest. Now, it seems that all of the case law being relied on by appellant here is more examples of, you know, how it's supposed to be done. And I've cited some case law myself to show that what happened here was indeed an arrest. I think that the Gehrke case that I was able to cite, G-E-H-R-K-E, indicates in that matter pretty much what happened here.
That's an unpublished opinion, right?
It is. But it is illustrative of the fact that when someone is placed in handcuffs, which in that case was based apparently on a report of an actual crime, I believe there was a suspicion of a burglary in that case, they're arrested, which has no direct factual correlation here, of course, but the point is what matters. That when officers are placing someone in handcuffs, that person is under arrest in a situation like this. The example of when they would not be are in the other cases cited by appellant. Munson, for example, where there were multiple suspects, they had a prior report of possible drugs and guns in the vehicle, but they had to deal with three or four suspects in that case, and the court found that sort of handcuffed detention, which was brief, was necessary for investigation. And in this case, as the officers admitted, there wasn't even a report of a crime that they received. The caller from the White Castle, I think it was, said there was possible property damage, but that was the most that they had. This was the first thing that defense counsel covered during the evidentiary hearing on cross-examination. He asked what their normal procedure is. And on page 26 of the transcript, the officer that was being questioned, Jasadamua, I think, pointed out that in a situation like this with a call, he said, the procedure is that it could be a medical emergency. We may not even have a suspect. So direct from the officer's mouth is what the situation was here. They arrived without any actual or firmly reported crime, such as the officers had in Gehrke, in Munson, in Hambleton, the other case relied on by the state. And all they do is see him sitting in the car. They have their emergency lights on. So that's another factor in considering that this is an arrest. And their commands for him to put his hands in front and then step out of the vehicle all constitute circumstances where it's clear he wasn't free to leave.
Am I correct? Didn't the officer testify that in a typical slumper car, they would not cuff somebody, but in this case, they did cuff him because of his furtive movements, his reaching behind him, and therefore they didn't know either what was in his possession or what was in the vehicle. Wasn't that a key fact in this case?
Well, it was a key claim by the officer, which the trial judge rejected as inadequate for the level of intrusion and restraint that was exercised here. The fact is, as I pointed out in my brief, a mere reach stands in strong contrast to the Flowers case cited by appellant, where there were furtive movements and actual digging for 45 seconds before he was taken out of the vehicle and handcuffed, which was found to be excessive. The judge noted that Mr. Manuel was immediately compliant. I cited the Lopez case, State v. Lopez, as an example of how a possible slumper call is appropriately handled, where the officer approached the vehicle and just knocked on the window. The driver was passed out. And attempts were made to check the driver's status before the driver was seized. And of course, once the window or the door was open in Lopez, the odor of alcohol was immediately detected. And at that point, the arrest occurred. But that's not what happened here. The officers went immediately to arrest mode. This is not reasonable. It may have been 3:30 in the morning in a parking lot, but these restaurants are open all night for a reason. And if they had evidence of a crime going on or had reason to believe that he was intoxicated, you'd think they would have reported that. They didn't. They didn't know what his status was. In all intents and purposes, this was a welfare check. And it went immediately to arrest.
Are you saying, Mr. Maravilli, that there's no element of officer safety in this case?
With two officers present and a reach to the back seat, there may have been. I would concede that, but there is no case law saying that any movement by a passenger immediately justifies seizure, arrest, and search like this. As I point out in my brief,
appellant pointed to a number of other circumstances besides the reaching, the time of day, that it was late at night, the location, it was a holiday weekend. Why don't the totality of the circumstances give rise to a concern for officer safety in this case?
Because reasonableness, again, is the framework here, is the touchstone. They didn't have a report of a crime. They didn't observe any crime. They didn't see any property damage. They had an immediately compliant vehicle occupant. If any one of those factors were different, I would admit I would be on shakier ground here. But the Fourth Amendment and our own Constitution are supposed to be a check on the degree of police intrusion before it happens, not a post-seizure checklist to check it by. My client was sitting in his car, not doing a thing, and he was awake.
Mr. Maley, Terry itself is a case where, and of course, that was not a person in a car, it was a person on the sidewalk, but Terry authorizes an officer who has begun an investigative detention to frisk somebody momentarily, briefly, in order to ensure officers. It allows the officers to take certain steps for the purposes of officer safety. Similarly, Mims versus Pennsylvania is a case which is heavily influenced by officer safety, which says an officer may remove someone from a vehicle for the purposes of officer safety. I mean, I think there's a lot of case law that follow those cases in the circumstances when there is, and still the courts recognize that what we have is an investigative detention, not an arrest. How would you respond to, why do Mims and Terry not apply in this case?
Because it's a question of degree, Your Honor, which I've tried to maintain throughout my response here. If this decision by the trial judge is overturned and the actions of the officers upheld as legal here, then no passenger at any time is going to be safe if they engage in any movement whatsoever prior to the officer approaching their vehicle in any traffic stop.
Well, let's say not any movement, but let's say you could flip this too. If we were to affirm, and if that were precedential, if a occupant of a vehicle reaches behind in darkness, reaches behind the driver's seat, and the rest of the vehicle has tinted windows, and so the officer can't see, and if the officer is intended to do an investigation into DWI, under your view, the officers could not take measures such as cuffing or perhaps even frisking to protect officer safety. Isn't that the reciprocal statement?
Well, I believe I'm reflecting the view of many decisions involved in this appeal, perhaps most applicably in response to your question, the State v. Flowers case relied on by appellant here, where they saw furtive movements for 45 seconds and placing him on the ground and in handcuffs was deemed as excessive, just as a Terry stop, because there were insufficient grounds to believe that he represented a threat when only a minor offense was suspected at that point, a traffic infraction. The officers here didn't even have that. There has to be a line drawn by the courts when it comes to police ability to seize people and handcuff them. And if we don't all want to think really hard about that right now, with everything going on in this city with the Minneapolis Police Department, then I don't know what else I can say here. My client was a young black man sitting in a car at night, and he was immediately arrested. I take exception to that. I don't know if that would have happened to a white driver. I don't think the officers had anything to go on to justify this, and I'm joined in that perspective by the district court.
Mr. Maravilli, I'd like to switch gears a bit as your time winds down and ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Murphy regarding the legal standard for when arrest occurs. The Brendlin case is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2007. It reiterates the Mendenhall case from 1980. So Brendlin post-dates the cases referred to in Champion, for example, and Moffitt. So it's 10 years and 17 years after those cases that we have Brendlin. Since that time, it's been cited 690 different times by U.S. courts, 18 times in the last 18 months by circuit courts of appeal for the United States. Is that the law or is it not the law for us to apply the free to leave language from Brendlin? Does that apply or not?
Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that it is a case, matter of welfare of EDJ from 1993, which controls here, which diverged Minnesota law from the federal standard by saying that there doesn't even need to be a physical seizure for someone to feel like they're not free to leave. A reasonable person not feeling free to leave is the standard, and we have to look to our own Supreme Court first. And then I think all of the case law that has been put in here, and in that Hambleton case cited by appellant, talking about how in most situations where even DUI is suspected, handcuffing is unnecessary. The handcuffing was unnecessary here, and it was immediate, and it constituted an arrest of my client, as the district court found. Thank you.
Judge Bryan, may I ask one more question, please?
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Maravilli, would you agree that this case rises or this appeal rises or falls based upon the timing of the arrest, when the arrest is determined to have occurred?
Not just the timing, no, Your Honor, the lack of circumstances to justify it as well, including the momentary reach, which for all they knew, or it could have been just a reach to the glove compartment, as I pointed out in my brief. So that's going to be somebody who gets taken out of their car and handcuffed? That's not right. They needed more here. They needed to employ investigative skills instead of just jacking somebody up. Thank you.
If I may follow up, Judge Bryan, I asked that question because it's the only brief point in your brief. You raise one issue. The district court, I think, first found that an arrest had occurred upon his being removed and cuffed. And then after determining that sort of that premise, then analyzed whether the facts provided the officers with probable cause for that arrest, concluded that they did not. And then in the alternative, analyzed whether there was reasonable suspicion for a seizure if the removing and cuffing was merely a seizure. That's my reading of the district court order. In your responsive brief, you've briefed only that first point, and so it makes me wonder whether you are arguing that that's the only basis for affirming the district court.
The timing of it, Your Honor?
Well, I think the main brief point that you have at page 4, respondent was arrested without probable cause when he was immediately ordered out of his vehicle and handcuffed. And that's really, I think, the sole issue, the sole brief point in your brief.
Well, yes, but as my ensuing analysis, I believe, shows, what I was really examining was whether the circumstances were there to justify the arrest. So that's why I'm answering you the way I am, sir, that it's not just the timing. It's that there was no basis to support that arrest at the moment they decided to do it, and then we're in the process of doing it.
So I guess my question is, let's say if we were to disagree with the district court that the removing and the cuffing was an arrest, if we were to deem that merely an investigative detention, you're not arguing that there's an absence of reasonable suspicion for such a detention.
I did argue that in my brief. I just characterized it as an arrest to follow suit with the district court. And by support for what I just said, I analyzed Flowers very thoroughly, which was only analyzed at the Terry level and found to be unreasonable, even for a guy who was seen committing traffic violations and then had furtive movements for 45 seconds. So I do believe I state later in my brief, after my Flowers analysis, which came on pages 11 and 12 of my brief, that there are no justifiable Terry circumstances here either, because they had no crime reported to them. They saw no evidence of a crime. They saw one brief reach to the back seat before they immediately went to seizure mode and put him in handcuffs. So no, Your Honor. I hope that my brief reflects that this was an unjustified seizure in any regard, but I treated it as an arrest because the district court did.
Thank you very much. Ms. Murphy, rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honor's respondent has cited to several cases, and I think that clarification is needed. To start off with, the holding of State v. Flowers is not that the handcuffing was excessive. It is that during the course of the traffic stop, the fourth search, in that case, they had frisked the defendant, frisked the vehicle, dog sniffed the vehicle, had no contraband or weapons, and then searched the vehicle a fourth time. By that point, the court held that that was impermissible in its scope. The court did find that the furtive movements did provide reasonable articulable suspicion for criminal activity and dangerousness. And there isn't a prerequisite for how long furtive movements need to be. We can't have officers out there timing furtive movements until it gets to a spot where they think it's been enough time. That's not providing officers the tools they need, and it's second guessing that this court in State v. Ballinger, also cited by respondent, said was unnecessary. The Fourth Amendment reasonableness covers officer safety. As this court said in Ballinger, reasonable suspicion of a weapon will almost invariably justify a reasonable use of force, which is what we had here. Respondent also points to Gerkey, unpublished, and says that is on point. The facts of that case are an opposite. There, officers were responding to information of a prior crime. There was no contemporaneous suspicion. And this court noted that it was clear that they didn't intend to investigate. They came to arrest the defendant for that prior burglary. Here, officers came to investigate a slumper, and during the course of that, there was suspicious conduct that led them to behave and respond the way they did. It's unreasonable.
I'd like to ask about the potential difference in applying the U.S. Constitution versus the Minnesota State Constitution in this case. Many of the cases that both parties have cited today and in their briefs make a distinction in ways that may be important. So are you arguing today that we are applying the same under both, or is this one of those situations where we have more protection under Minnesota State Constitution, such as in Askaruth?
Askaruth really does provide the framework here in terms of using a Terry analysis for a traffic stop. This isn't an area where the Minnesota Supreme Court has specifically designated outside of Askaruth that the Article 1, Section 10 deviates. I do hear Your Honor's concern about the U.S. Supreme Court law of not free to leave. And even if we apply that standard, if we only apply not free to leave, let's look at respondent in a reasonable person situation. He has just awoken up in the drive-through. Officers are approaching the car. He reaches behind him. It's dark. The windows are tinted. And the officers are saying, put your hands on the wheel. Stop digging around behind you. And then before they can do any investigation, they arrest him. So I think that is supports this conclusion that a reasonable person wouldn't think I'm being formally arrested. They think I'm being detained because I was just reaching behind me. And in fact, that's what the officers told me. So even if we just focus on that one part of the test, which again, there's other United States Supreme Court case law cited throughout the briefs, which give you a lot of other factors to look at. But if we even just look at that, a reasonable person in respondent's position would not believe this was a formal arrest. Officers were quickly responding to the perceived threat. And case law says that we don't get to second guess those actions when they were acting on reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity and dangerousness. The handcuffs don't automatically transform an investigative detention into an arrest, and they didn't here. Facts and circumstances are critically important. And in this case, the officers perceived a threat that was reasonable. We can't have an unworkable standard that a few seconds of furtive movements isn't enough. This also doesn't create the slippery slope argument that respondent is pushing for, that suddenly no one can reach for the glove compartment. Reversing the district court here actually affirms all of the precedent. The district court is the errant decision maker here, and we're asking this court to reverse to respect the fact that the officers were acting within the Terry framework reasonably and diligently in the circumstances. We ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you both very much. The arguments were well-reasoned, and we appreciate how well-written the briefs were. The panel will take this case under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory deadline. Thank you all. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you.